My passage starts on page 85 and goes to page 90. Negro misappropriation of Greek mythology, or I know niggers that'll kick Hercules' ass. I left the smoggy Los Angeles death shroud, searching for ghetto muses. Anyone seen Calliope? Heard she emigrated to the San Fernando Valley, fulfilled her ranch-style dreams, with epic afternoon soap operas and bong water bubble baths. Outside, listening for voices, I hear nothing, the leaves are silent, and the chee-chee birds look at me like I'm crazy. You tell that dime dropper Cleo she better not leave her witness protection program. I seen some stone killers passing her picture down by the 7-Eleven. On the slope banks of the LA River, I sit cross-legged, classical guru pose, my 50-cent Bic pen taut with possibilities. Thalia's bloated body floats by, zigzagging between Firestone radios, finally catching itself on the rusted barbs of a shopping cart seriously lost at sea. Euterpe is at the talent show, begging entrance into the church basement, permission to sing her Patti LaBelle covers, promising the big record label she won't smoke up the production money like last time. On my knees, I place my ear to the concrete. I hear nothing, no thundering cavalry hooves, kicking up dust, no war whoops, not even the ghost town winds of massacre. I have a notion that if I could translate the slobbering bellows of Ray Ray, the ubiquitous retarded boy's swollen-tongued incantations, I'd find Melpomene reciting the day's obituaries. Anyone here speak Down syndrome or crack baby? Running my hands over three-bark braille, swashbuckling with palm tree leaves. Nothing. Paper cuts. On guard, motherfucker. Ham radio signals, SOS, APB, 911 electronic prayers, to the goddess Urania's voicemail, go unanswered. Late last night, my man picked up a jailhouse phone. Yo nigga, you got to come down and get me out. And I was inspired. The next morning, I rummaged through the attic and found a can of black spray paint and the stencils my great-great-uncle, Wolfgang, used to do his Jim Crow handiwork. I painted the poem on the wall that surrounds Hillside. Surprisingly, my still-wet verse didn't look out of place between the specious rest-in-peace calligraphic elegies and the fading Ubermensch graffiti already splashed on the wall. I was eating cereal and watching the Sunday morning TV journalist discussing the prospect of substantive black rule in South Africa when Nick Scobie knocked on the door. He had his headphones on, and his arms were filled with the Montgomery Ward trim-lined steam iron that dripped water, an ironing board, a can of starch, and a pile of brand-new white t-shirts. He walked in, propped up the board with a loud squeak, and plugged the iron into a nearby socket. What you listening to? Toshiko Akiyoshi. Who? A piano player. You met Psycho Loco last night, I heard. Yeah? So? Listen to you. Yeah? So? Can you imagine the Indians meeting Christopher Columbus and saying, big deal, some midget with syphilis and a bad cold. So fucking what? Pass the buffalo meat. You're Psycho Loco's next-door neighbor, and he likes you. Likes me how? He likes you. Ever had a murderer like you before? Psycho Loco is going to come over to your house and ask you for favors. Borrow a cup of sugar, hold on to his gun, put your sister in a headlock, and ask you kindly to tell the police he spent the night at your house playing Scrabble. Shit like that. You're involved, Holmes. You're gonna have to respect something more than yourself. You know that saying? Fate chooses our relatives, we choose our friends. Malheur et pitié, Canto 1, 1803. Well, here in the street, that shit works in reverse. Fate picks your friends, and you choose your family. Everybody starts out like an orphan in this hole. Gunnar, you're gonna have to respect Psycho Loco and the neighborhood, and the way things get done here. Psycho Loco and the gun-totten hooligans try to kill people. People their perception of fate has stated as the enemy. This ain't Hatfields and McCoys. Nobody's birth certificate says Joe Cripp, Sam Peru, and I definitely don't know niggers surnamed hooligan. Some Irish homies, maybe. If Psycho Loco says you're his friend, there ain't nothing you can do about it. You're friends because he says so. Now, there might be some fool who lives on the other side of town who thinks you're his arch enemy simply because Psycho Loco likes you. That is fate, Black. Maybe people with money can skew fate in their favor, but that ain't us. I seen that poem you wrote on the way over here. There was a gang of motherfuckers reading it like a washed poster. Oh yeah, nigga 13 years old and you involved now. Scobie ripped open a plastic bag, pulled out a t-shirt, and stretched it over the pointy end of the ironing board. He sprayed the starch over the shirt, licked his finger, pressed it to the bottom of the iron, and listened to the sizzle. Watch, he said. The iron cackled and spit as it glided over the shirt. When Scobie got to one of the factory wrinkles, he pressed the steam button, and the iron exhaled plumes of vapor, and the wrinkles vanished. After ironing the front and back of the shirt, he snatched it off the end and laid the sleeves on the board. Carefully aligning the hems, he dug the iron into the material, putting a stiletto-sharp crease in each sleeve. Don't put no creases anywhere else. No crease down the back. That's the east side. No military double creases down the front from the collar to the end of the sleeve, like them buster-ass niggers from XXY chromosome recidivists. No, go get a pair of pants. I don't care what happens. I will never put a fucking crease in my Levi's. No fucking way, man. I will never be that involved. Scobie laughed and asked if my mother had given me enough money for basketball shoes. I pulled $200 from an envelope marked basketball paraphernalia and fanned the crisp $20 bills, wondering if it was enough to change my fate. The shoes. Buying basketball shoes was much harder than I thought. Unlike the skate shop, where there were only 3 different brands and maybe 10 styles to choose from, Tennies from Heaven was the footwear equivalent of an automobile showroom. A sneaker emporium where the walls were lined with hundreds of shoes and salesmen dressed in silk sweatsuits patrolled the floor, handing out brochures, shaking hands, and checking credit ratings. The basketball section took up the entire third floor. An $80 sneaker caught my eye, and I hefted it in my hand as if its weight might tell something about its quality. I was about to call for a salesperson when I heard Scobie snickering behind my back and singing, "Buddies, they cost $1.99. Buddies, they make your feet feel fine." I put the shoe down, and Nicholas pushed me through a sliding glass door into an area of the store called the Proving Grounds, a section of the store where the state-of-the-art, more expensive models were on display. Before the staff allowed me to try on any shoes, I had to sign a release stating that if my new sneakers were forcibly removed from my feet and the crime received any media attention, I would blame the theft on the current administration and not the niche marketing. Even with all the paperwork, I could only try on one shoe at a time, since I wasn't accompanied by a bonded legal guardian or a basketball coach. Whenever I slipped my foot into a new shoe, I'd hobble over to the mirror like Tiny Tim Cratchit and blink really fast, trying to create an optical illusion so I could imagine what wearing both sneakers at the same time would look like. After some eye strain, I managed to convince the guy to let me try a different shoe on each foot and teetered over to Nicholas to ask his opinions. He vetoed the sporty Barbarian on my left foot because they were sewn by 8-year-old Sri Lankans who worked in open-air factories, received no lunch breaks, and were paid in candy bars. The Air ID Amin Fire Walker on my right foot, a colorful suede high top designed to look like a traditional African mask, was nixed because although the shoes performed well on asphalt, they tended to slip on gym floors. And besides, the kids chanted coup d'été at anyone who wore them. Nick suggested the high-tech Adidas Forum 2s, an outrageously expensive pair of plain white basketball shoes, computer-designed for maximum support, something called wearability, and exactly like the pair he was wearing. The salesperson, smelling commission, closed the deal with a spiel about French cowhide hand-sewn with French thread by French seamsters who were paid by French entrepreneurs who donated a percentage of every shoe sold to help build basketball courts in ghettos throughout the world. I wanted to comment on how building more basketball courts just created demand for more sneakers, but instead gimped around the store, hopped up and down on one foot, and put $175 on the counter. The salesman smiled and handed me the other shoe and the carbon copy of my release form.